G'day everyone and welcome to Life in the Peloton. This is another episode. I'm sitting here with Lionel to preview this episode, mate. Welcome to the preview.
Hello Mitch, how are you doing?
I'm doing well actually. I've recovered. I had the opening weekend. I'm back into racing. I'm into the full racing calendar right now. I've had the Het Volk or Het Nieuwsblad. I keep calling it that race. I don't know why. It's something wrong with me. Het Nieuwsblad. Kern and Brussels Kern just a couple of days ago. The week before that, I had Hoed Vaar, which certainly really shocked the system. This weekend was a shock, but not as much as I thought it would normally be.
Back on the cobbles. I mean, Het Volk, for listeners who are perhaps a bit newer to cycling, it's been called Het Nieuwsblad for a number of years now because the Het Nieuwsblad newspaper, which runs the race now, took over the old Het Volk newspaper, which founded the race, I think just after the Second World War. So like a lot of races, stage races and one-day races, started by newspaper people. So yeah, if people are a bit unsure of why it's got this strange name, Omloop Het Nieuwsblad basically means Circuit Het Nieuwsblad, but it goes around all of the Flandrian climbs, doesn't it? They call it the sort of mini Tour of Flanders, and it's not all that mini, is it? 200k cobbles, climbs, a tough day out.
It's a very tough day out, and typically it has very bad weather because it's sort of that month before or three weeks before the classics normally kick off, and it's just that little bit earlier. It's spring, well, spring has just sprung, but it's typically freezing cold and raining. And I tell you what, we stroke a luck card this year because it was sunny. It was 10 degrees and sun, and it really changed the racing. I'm not going to say it was easier, but it just made the elements much better, and you weren't fighting the elements, you were just fighting the race, which is hard enough in itself. But I really need to set up this episode because I love talking about this weekend, and normally I preview this weekend with Luke Durbridge because the classics are here and I can finally talk about the classics, and Durbo is a good mate of mine and loves the classics as well. But I thought, well, last year was a great idea that we went on the road with Strada Bianchi. I thought, hang on, I'm going to be traveling with a teammate of mine, Tom Scully. I don't think a lot of people know about him. He's a great guy. How about we go on the road with myself and Tom Scully? But there was a few hiccups on the way. It wasn't as smooth sailing as I thought. We went to the airport on Wednesday, and how it normally happens is we go up on the Wednesday. Thursday, we do a recon of the race. We check out all the old climbs, the roads and everything again, familiarize ourselves. Friday, we have a rest, and Saturday, we're into it. Saturday and Sunday, we're racing. So Tom Scully and I get up. We get up to Barcelona because these are new protocols now with COVID. We had a test on Sunday morning before our last stage of Hoed Vaar. We thought a COVID test. We thought that would be perfect to fly out on Wednesday. Lo and behold, we get to the airport Wednesday. They tell us to check in. You've missed the 72-hour required time for a test slot for Belgium. We missed it by a couple of hours. We can't let you on the flight. Go home and get another test. It was a disaster. Yeah, it was a disaster. So we just went, well, what are we going to do? We missed the recon. But at that moment there, I thought, you know what? I'm going to start the recording. This is actually not too bad. Let's talk about it. So I was out on the road with Tom. We started the recording that day and we let the weekend unfold. And I have you guys with us the whole weekend. It's a bit of a different episode, but along the way, we talk about the opening weekend, we talk about the recon, we talk about Tom Scully. It's great to find out who he is too and how he got to be pro. So I really wanted you guys to feel like you're with me along the way. I hope that's the feeling you get. Anyway, if you don't, there's some really good nuggets in there and some great stuff to listen to. Without further ado, I hope it set that up for you. Sit back and enjoy this one. A weekend on the road with the EF boys doing the first classics of the year. Enjoy, guys. Morning, mate.
How are you?
Good, and you?
Good.
Do you want to have a chat about where we're going?
Sure, yeah. Good results, you know?
Yeah, I did mine this morning.
Yeah.
So here we are, just before we take off. Where are we, mate?
We're at the big roundabout that takes you out to the bottom of Owls by the bike shop, just 2 minutes down the hill from your place.
But more importantly, what country are we in?
Girona.
Where should we be?
We should be in Belgium. Right now, we should be in Belgium.
So now we're doing today's our own recon, Spanish opening weekend recon. Should we hit it?
Let's do it.
All right, buddy. What do we normally do on a Belgian opening weekend recon? It's the first recon of the classics. What do you normally do on that weekend?
So yeah, normally probably travel up 3 days before. The likes of today, Thursday would be recon day. We'd all meet at the hotel the night before. We'd get on the bus in the morning and roll out to part of the course that the DS is sees being the hard part, or where the final is going to start, and then went right from there to the finish line just to check the equipment, the tyres, bikes. Here's the phone, but oh, here's the big boss here, Andreas.
Alright, Andreas is calling in. What the big boss have to say?
He just said you guys are not the only ones. He's heard other teams also had guys not making it, so who knows where they're doing their recon, but we're down here on the Costa Brava doing ours.
And that's what I wanted to say. How's our recon looking so far? So we've hit around the ups and downs of Lagostera. Now we're doing the Murder Romagna,
a bit of a recovery down the other side and over into La Bisbal.
Alright, we'll check in later. Alright mate, recon done. We're coming down Els Angels back into Girona. How are your sensations out there, mate?
Oh, best recon ever had, mate.
Weather's good now, sunny, few nice climbs. Ready for Belgium.
Yeah, it's what we know down here in this part of the world, so just gotta soak it up now. Couple hours on the plane and we'll be up there.
All right, let's get it done. All right, well now we're in the car and we're on our way to Barca, day two. Tom's driving.
Belgium Classics, here we come.
All right, well let's get away from the classics for a minute and find out who I'm actually talking to. Tom Scully from Cromwell, New Zealand, down the South Island, very south, down near Invercargill. Scud, tell me, someone from down that way, because there's no other real cyclist from down that way apart from Greg Henderson that I know of, how does someone like you get into cycling opposed to, you know, being a blindside flanker in aspiring to be an All Black? Scud, tell us about the beginning.
Yeah, well, basically, I was just there down in New Zealand playing rugby.
What position were you playing?
Anywhere in the forwards, really, apart from the front row. So my older brother and his mate started cycling. Good family friends of ours. And we used to go off to the cycling races with them. And once the rugby season had stopped, I'd sort of just tag along and just go and watch. And the guys would pry into me, you know, where's your bike? Why aren't you racing, you know? And then eventually I sort of just did it, you know, got in with the, got a bike and got started with friends of ours, the Tools, and they trained me up and committed to cycling for a couple of years there. I went up to the Nationals under 17, had not much idea about what was going on the track, and crashed in the warm-up and hitting my pedal on the bottom of the velodrome and these sort of things, you know. Made all those mistakes. Came back down and said, all right, well, if I want to get into this cycling stuff, I'd better give it a go for a while. And I had an after-school job at a bike shop just to, you know, learn a little bit about bikes in Cromwell. And I said, well, the kids said I should go to the other under-19s, under-17s, so I should come down to Invercargill and get started there, ride with them, because there wasn't many kids racing in Cromwell. Like, there's my brother, his mate, and that was another mate of ours, and that was it, you know. So there was no real bunch rides, like big bunches, you know, and racing regularly. So I was like, I'll go down to Invercargill, like the other guys said, and get started.
What attracted you to it? Because, you know, like I said, and I was maybe a bit similar to you, I was playing rugby as well before I started cycling. And I think what attracted me back then was cycling was an individual sport, and the work I put in was what I got out of it. Whereas with rugby and cricket, it was a team sport, and sometimes you were working really hard or focused or, you know, whatever, but your teammates were just doing it because they had to or just couldn't be bothered that day. And, you know, that was something that I loved about cycling in the beginning. What about you? Like, you were going out there, you said you were watching it, but you weren't being in the, you weren't competing at that point. And then you started competing, and then you decided to go to the nationals, the track. What was attracting you all this time? Why were you keep coming back? Why were you going to just go against the grain and do this sport? Like you said, there was only three people doing it in your town. You know, there wasn't a big attraction to it. What attracted you in those early, early days?
Yeah, you're right. For me, it was like we were playing rugby. We trained on Tuesdays and Thursday nights, you know. And come through the winter, you know, Cromwell's close to the mountains. And so every Thursday, the school would take trips to go up the mountains for skiing and snowboarding. So the option was you leave at 10 in the morning and come home at 6, sometimes 7 at night on a Thursday and do your skiing and snowboarding for a day. But then that would take like half the rugby team, you know. So, well, there's a few of us who wouldn't do the ski trips and would just stay and do the practices. Then they would have 6 guys turn up to practice on Thursday afternoon. We've got to play a game on Saturday, and then there's maybe 11 turn up, or, you know, or it was pretty hard to patch it together. So you ended up playing like under 18s with my brother and his mates, as well as the under 15s. And like, sort of just mixed one team and out of the two, you know. So I was like, well, the attraction of cycling got me sort of removed that. As much as it is a team sport for us now, it's an individual sport as well. So the training side of it, I could go and train, and the work, like you said, the work I put in was the work I got out. I sort of found that you can't, like, you can't do a full season of rugby and then just start doing half a season of cycling halfway through, because the kids down in the cities were like already doing a full season of cycling, and then you turn up and obviously what happens, you get first few races, you're pretty nervous and you get dropped and you get spat and you go through all those mistakes that you make when you're under 17s, you know.
Was that happening when you went to that first nationals and you went, okay, whoa, if I really want to do this, I've got to get serious? And then obviously you were at the bike shop and these guys gave you the link and said, well, if you want to get serious, you've got to go down to Invercargill. Is that sort of how it happened?
Pretty much. Like, we used to do the like standing start practice just on a quiet road. Like, take the track bikes out with the scooter and just find a quiet road in the countryside to do standing starts. And then we'd chase onto the back of the scooter to get the speed up. And early, early days, you know.
Did the track bikes have brakes or?
No. Just a heavier tubular tyre so you didn't puncture it when you're on the road.
How did you slow down at the end of the standing start? The road was long enough.
Yeah, it's just a long straight road, yeah, in the countryside.
All right, well, take me now then, that transition. Okay, I want to get serious. The boys are like, all right, mate, you got to get out of here. You got to go down Invercargill to the big smoke and get down where was the indoor track there then and get into that. What was that transition like?
Yeah, so at this time, Invercargill, they were just building. They've been doing it, like campaigning for many years about building a, you know, upgrading their track. And the dream of a 250 indoor was like the gold standard, you know. So that was the dream. And then the awesome community down there put it together. And it was happening. So just at the time I started cycling, it was all happening. So I went to the nationals, I got dusted, I came back. I had the option of, you know, living with my auntie and uncle, and like the other under 17s, under 19s, they were like, why don't you come to Invercargill and race? And back to my after school job at the bike shop and Saturday mornings, I told how the trip went at the nationals with the mechanic, and he's like, nah, righto, that's it, you're going to Invercargill. He just decided for me. I was 16, like, he's like, you're going to Invercargill, and we'll ring the shop down there. They're just setting up another cycle surgery down there in Invercargill, and said, we'll ring them, we'll tell them we've got an after school boy here, knows what he's doing, he's going to come in if you've got a job for him, that's what he needs.
Tell me a little bit about now training, and you can probably allude to this a little bit more in the recent times, but training in those early days around home and around Invercargill, because this is something a lot of people don't understand, that who have just access to different roads, different loops, you know, hills, whatever, you know, anyone around the world, not anyone, but most people around the world have good training in their area. They can get there, they can do it. Tell me a little bit about the road training around your area.
Back at mum and dad's in Cromwell, we got a lake, and is option one is up the right-hand side of the lake. Option two is up the left-hand side of the lake. The shortest loop you can do around the lake is 90 kilometres, and then the left side goes all the way up the west coast of New Zealand, so you go as far as you want. And the other one goes up the centre of the New Zealand through the Mackenzie country, so you go as far as you want. And there is two more roads, one down to Alexandra, but it's pretty busy, and the other one coming through from Queenstown, like, you only want to ride that one way. So the second option you have for a loop is up to the next town, Wanaka. It's like 60 kilometres. Basically just winds its way up, no intersections, and then you turn left there, and then you go over the hill, and then you loop back around, and that's a 150k loop.
So when you were growing up, I guess you weren't doing too many massive rides, but, you know, was it more or less, I'm going out that road and back, and I'm going to go up that road tomorrow and back? Is that what you did?
Pretty much exactly that. And, you know, it's quite windy in the valley up there where the lake is. It's kind of like a massive valley. So either one way's 18Ks an hour into the headwind, and the other way's, you know, 36, 40, 50, depends how strong the wind is. So, yeah, the Invercargill was pretty appealing after Cromwell because there was just roads going everywhere. Pretty flat down there, but it was just a big rural community where roads going left, right and centre, and pretty windy down there too, and a fair bit of rain coming in off the coast, but yeah, the wind definitely made you strong.
Can you compare there to anywhere else in the world that you visited in your travels?
I'd have to say the asphalt in Cromwell would be the heaviest, slowest asphalt in the world that I have found so far. So those early days where I was riding to the top of the lake and back, like 30 k's up, you can't feel anywhere else is deader and slower.
In a headwind.
In a headwind. Oh, she's not fast.
So tell me now, take me back to where you were. You're on the track, you're starting to find your legs in the track, and was it the national program you're aspiring to, or the Olympics, or what was your main drive in those early years before you started undiscovering sort of the road pro scene? And tell me about those years down in Invercargill.
Yeah, so at that time, the Kiwi under 19 boys had either just won or were just about to win the world title in the team's pursuit, like under 19 level. And I, like, under 17, I would have been in, like, I think there was maybe a magazine or something like that that they were in. I was just learning this track thing, and they'd just done that. I was like, oh, that's pretty cool. I want to do that. This was the dream or idea in the back of my head. And so, yeah, I was getting stuck into the track racing, the local carnivals and stuff. And, you know, it was just looking up to guys like Sam Bewley. We still ride with them today. At the time, some of the older guys were there, Hayden Ralston, Mark Ryan, off racing World Cups and stuff in the National Elite Men's Team. And Jesse Sargent, Wesley Goff, Pete Latham, these guys were all, like, I guess over the 2 years we progressed into under-19s, myself and Shane Archibald, and, like, we were sort of the next phase through, doing a lot of training camps and even World Cups with these guys from time to time. The first Junior Worlds for me was Mexico, training up, building up, making into the national team, obviously with the Nationals, good performances there. Off to Mexico, didn't go well at all. Back the last year under-19 was the Junior Worlds in Cape Town, South Africa. Again, didn't go well at all. If I knew what I know now, I'd probably do things a little bit different, but at that time you just go on with whatever the advice you've got and training flat out, and then maybe it's not the best way, you know. Yeah. So you learn these things, and another campaign off to Cape Town, and I was like, whoa, gee, I've been going at this cycling for a while now, like, you know, some school years had just finished up, and I had to come back. I had a bit of a rest. I was back up in Cromwell at mum and dad's, and, like, I just started working in a wine bottling plant, and just factory processing, like, empty bottles on a conveyor, gets filled up, boxing, packaging, moving pallets, all that stuff. I did that for about a couple of months, maybe 2 or 3 months, just to get some money together. And then, like, whoa, gee, you know, working in a factory, you know, it was good time, because I was like, oh yeah, I've got some money coming in now. It's not like, this is good, I can get saving up for more bike parts or whatever. And then I was like, all right, I'm going to ride the Tour of Southland, and so I better get fit for that in November. And after two failed Junior Worlds, I was sort of a bit distanced from it all, and then trained up for the Tour of Southland, and just raced full gas, with Gordon McCauley actually at that time. It was my first tour of Southland. We had a good team's time trial prologue, and next thing you know, the national team track coach is calling me up and saying, hey, good performances there in the Tour of Southland. Do you want to come off to Melbourne to race the World Cup in 2 weeks' time?
And so then, yeah, okay, so now you're in the senior track program, and were you starting to think then, okay, this is, you know, after you started to go along a little bit, were you starting to think, okay, this is what I want to do. This is good. This is where I've got my, you know, finding my feet, my strengths. You eventually go on to win a gold medal at the Commonwealth Games. You know, this is like, for the Commonwealth, it's I'm not going to say it's as good as an Olympic gold, but it's up there. You know, it's special to represent your country at the Commonwealth Games, to then go on and win a gold medal there on the track. So tell me about your idea about the track in the beginning and how it sort of changed over those years to the top there.
Yeah, basically, again, like junior worlds, nothing happens overnight. And off to that first World Cup, rode the Madison and maybe the scratch race or the points race, I think. Crashed in the Madison, you know, just never just boom, clicked straight away. Many more World Cups happened. Went off to an under 23 UIV, like a Madison. It was only a 3 day in Amsterdam. And then, so one World Tour of Southland, one World Cup, the 3 day in Amsterdam, over to Manchester for another World Cup, home for the Oceanias, and all of a sudden I've been around the world like bang, 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 but I've been racing constantly. And then things were like, on the track I could sort of, you know, move around all right after all that racing, did the good performances the Oceanias, and then boom, off to the world. So again, I think I crashed at the world. So like, it's part of racing, it's never really flowed that smoothly, but couple of years at the Worlds, and then I sort of went away from it because my performances weren't that good. The national team coach sort of said, okay, what's the plan now? We're off to Belgium and as a development team, and did a year over there with those boys.
Did they drop you from the national track team?
Well, it was a year of development on the road, and then come back for another summer of racing World Cups, Oceanias, think off to the Worlds, and then that's when the door closed. You know, like, I was proving myself riding for Southland against these older boys in the national team. Again, yeah, the Worlds didn't go so well. And then they said, okay, what's the plan now? I said, okay, we're going to come back to Belgium. But I sort of thought, well, okay, come back to Belgium. I didn't make the Commonwealth Games for Delhi. I was going to do 3 months in Belgium and then just do development stuff again. It's like, no, I'm going to go. I've got a road team that I want to go and ride for. And then that's right, sort of there and then in that sit-down meeting with the high performance director at the time, was he said, oh, okay, well, we want you to come to Belgium. If you want to go and ride for your road team, well, best of luck.
Yeah, that's it. That's it on the track, in other words.
Yeah, basically. And so it was my second year with this Chipotle development team. It's a team under 23 development team based out of America. And the second year, they wanted us to live in Toulouse. I was like, yeah, sweet, off to Europe. And then we lived in Toulouse and we did all the races that the development continental level teams were doing.
So who was in this under 23 team?
So we had Steele Von Hoff, who I met in Singapore on the way over. We did a crit together. Lockie Morden, Danny Summerhill, Jacob Rath, a stack of American guys. Alex Howes had been there in the past, like he'd just moved up to the pro team. So, yeah, like, we were pretty sweet. Like, at the time, we were a development team for Garmin Sharp. We had all the Cannondale bikes, all the Giro helmets, everything we could basically need, want, or should have to be racing in Europe. We lived down in Toulouse in this massive country farmhouse, like 10Ks from any village, let alone city. So there was a few driving lessons going in one of the team cars on how to get to the supermarket. Guys had never driven a manual car before. And then that only lasted for about 3 months because the car eventually broke down. And so no more driving to the supermarket because we needed the other car to get to the races. So we had one car, one mechanics van, and we would just drive all the way up France, Olympia Store, Tour of Normandy, Tour de Bretagne. Off to Italy sometimes for Val d'Aosta. All these races, like week-long stage races that you know, when you're 22 years old, it just, you just soak up.
And just fending for yourself there in this house, like you said, you, I remember you telling me this story once. It was, okay, we can't use the car for groceries anymore. Once a week or once every so often, the neighbour down the road would take you up. And if not, you'd just go on your bike.
Yeah, pretty much. We were so lucky to meet this neighbour. Lockie just met him out training one day. He said hello instead of saying bonjour. And the guy was like, what? You guys speak English? You know, and then all of a sudden he was in our house and like having barbecues with him once a week. You know, he just looked after us, would run us to the supermarket. Midnight airport runs, like, loved it. The fact that we're an American team living just down the road from him.
Is he American?
Sorry, yeah, he's American himself with a French wife. So awesome people. I've been back to see them pretty much every year, bar two, since then, just for a visit, you know.
What were you thinking at this point now, just to get your head around where you're at? You're 22, a long way away from the south of New Zealand now. You're now just sort of completely immersed in the European road season, but you're not under the pro umbrella yet in terms of everything organised for you to a degree. You're still fending for yourself as an amateur, but now you're not with your family. You're just with a bunch of boys in this house, and even a different situation. You're 10K from town, all this sort of stuff. Were you sort of loving it then, or were you just sort of going, I don't know about this. I'm a bit homesick. The racing side's cool, but it's all getting a bit much. What was your thoughts at that point as a 22-year-old?
One thing at that age is, yeah, it was a continental team, but like, they were paying me a little bit of money, like enough to I could live off comfortably and, you know, not be in the red. That was cool. Like, they, you treated a little bit like a professional, but also the end of the year was like, there's the thing called the stagiaire, you know. And that was like kind of my whole, like, I'd watch guys like Jesse and Sam come through the Livestrong program off the track. Jesse Sargent, you know, Sam Bewley on the Livestrong program, and they then did the stagiaire, and then they bumped up to the pro team, and I was like, well, that's kind of the pathway I want to take, but with my team, you know. And I was, you know, proved myself enough in that second year with the team that they wanted to give me a run as a stagiaire and an opportunity to step up. So not only had I done all these awesome races around France and around Europe, but then I got into the stagiaire role, and that was like, okay, this is the next step. I go and ride with the big boys, and it's not just about riding and racing results, and, you know, it's can you fit in and all this stuff as well. So yeah, then you're off to some real races. I think my first race was, I had to fly back to America. There was a 6 kilometer prologue. I took a TT bike, I took disc wheels, I took spare disc wheels, I took race wheels, I took my road bike, I took my spare bike. I took, this was like the first test, just travel with all this equipment by yourself from France to America. And I think it was the Tour of Elk Grove or something like that. At the time there was like Christian Vandervelde, he was racing. And I get there, right? And like normally a 6K prologue's probably pretty good for me, coming off the track and things like that. And we didn't have a DS because it was just a smaller race before. I think it was like the Tour of Colorado or something at the time, a bit of a warm-up for the older pros. And they basically just said to me, the mechanic said, all right, whatever happens, just go out there and ride really easy, like take it easy, because, you know, you need to just get around and be safe. I was like, okay, is this the first test for me as a stagiaire, whether I even listen or not, or what? I didn't know. This is how much I didn't know. So I go out there and I start off and I'm feeling pretty comfy, and I just took it easy. I get back to the bus and I still remember it. Christian Vandervelde was like, said something like, what happened, homie? The old dude smoked you or something like that. And I was like, well, I just, he said just ride easy. So I just rode easy, you know, like, and I just felt, oh, okay. Did the next 2 days and boom, I was back off to France. And
what happened with the stagiaire? It never eventuated into anything.
No, it didn't really, but I did a lot of cool races, Perry Tours, some time in Belgium. My last race for the season was heading back to New Zealand. They'd sent me to Japan Cup. Oh. And at this time, I'd already known that I wasn't getting a role with the big team. And I sort of coming like, well, yeah, that was pretty cool, and I'm doing all these races, and I want to sort of keep going, but I didn't have any options at all.
Were you really disappointed when you heard that, or it was something that, well, because like the way you made it sound there was, okay, I've seen Buells do it, I've seen Jesse do it, if I can just get that stagiaire role and do half okay, I'm probably going to get a contract. Is that what you sort of thought?
No, I didn't know at all. Oh. I sort of thought, like, yeah, of course that's what I hoped for, but I, at the same time, I didn't really know.
Yeah.
Like, it came through, there wasn't one on the table, so that was fine. And off to Japan Cup, and this one year at the race, Gary Beckett, he sort of said to me, what are you doing next year? Like, this was after Japan Cup, we're just having dinner at the hotel, and then flying out the next morning, he said, as we're packing up, he said, I know a team in the UK that might be a good fit for you. I think I had an iPad or something at the time. Like, you know, I didn't really have a phone that worked in Europe. That was another thing. But I had this iPad. I just sent him an email, the team that he suggested, and was Rally in the UK. I sent him an email. Hi, Gary's just recommended that your team would be a good fit for me. And then I got on the plane, flew back to New Zealand, like, had nothing. And I just didn't really know what my next steps was. But when I landed in New Zealand, there was already, like, yep, sounds great. Let's have a Skype call in the next few days when you land. So literally landed, mum and dad picked me up. We drove home to the airport. From the airport, it's like 50 Ks. And then opened the emails, and it was, let's have a Skype call. Had a conversation for about 20 minutes on Skype. And within like an hour of being home, there was a contract from this team. Because they were like, the UK time, it all just worked, you know, like, so literally 12-hour flight with nothing to 20 minutes in the door, and there's a contract on the table, and I'm off to the UK.
All right, so I thought I'd just quickly touch base, because this is quite a long trip, and we started in Girona this morning, went for a ride together, then we drove up to the airport in Barsad, then we flew to Frankfurt, which is where we're at now, and then we need to get across to Brussels. So we're at a little stop over here. It's like doing an international flight, and I just want to quickly get Tom's thoughts on what it's like travelling again after a big period and back in the weird way of travelling. I completely underestimated this again.
Yeah, it's definitely harder than it used to be. Things used to flow pretty easy at airports. I think we had 3 documents, maybe 4 documents needed just to get on the plane, for a starter. Procedures getting on and off the plane are a lot slower, loading the plane. Now we've got a 2-hour wait until the next one. It's going to be late night, so add it all up, and geez, not as fun as it used to be.
To get up to the classics, which are well worth it, which is my next question. Why do we love these things, the classics? Why do you love them? Because it's not a common thing for us, not being from Europe, especially not from Belgium. These guys grow up with this. For us, well, for me anyway, it was a thing I had to learn. I didn't really see it much on TV before I came across. The internet wasn't that big before I came across. Why did you find yourself, I don't know if you're in love with them, but why did you find yourself going into these classics, and what is it about these races that you like?
Well, it's definitely a love-hate relationship. They're just so bloody hard. Yeah, racing in small roads and rough roads, cobblestone roads, nothing feels fast about it on the concrete block roads that we do race on. Plus, then you enter into the cobblestones. You want to go fast, you have to be really on a good one. I remember my first time I did them, the feeling I had afterwards was like, holy shit, these are real bike races. These are really, really hard bike races.
Why?
Just because you go up there and you turn up and you think you're going pretty good, you know, you've trained pretty hard all winter, or in our case, we come off the Tour Down Under and the Sun Tour and the Cadell's race, and had a training camp, got all the new kit, you head up to Belgium, you think you're going pretty good, then all of a sudden you're not. You just get processed. It's a hard place to start.
You're just another number. That's the one thing I found out. It's like you said, you got to train hard. You've got to know as much as you can about the parkour. You've got to really fight. You've got to mentally motivate yourself continually throughout the day. Come on, no, this is where I want to be. Come on, keep moving up. Come on, come on. And to do all that, sometimes you're just another number, and that's a good day to not be spat out by the machine almost.
Exactly. If you're still in a reasonably sized group coming across the finish line, if you make it to the finish line, you've had a good day. You know, things have gone your way. You've had some luck. You've had obviously had the legs, and it's a good sign for things to come. It's just when we look at opening week, we call it opening weekend. And
why is it called the opening weekend?
It's the first time we race in Belgium, ahead of the classics season, the classics to come. So it's a great test to find out where you're at and how the winter training's stacked up ahead of the big classics to come.
Tell me about this with the opening weekends. The feeling I have for it, it can be the worst and the best thing for you, because what can happen up here is you can get a warped opinion either side. Explain that a bit more.
You can come up here and have a good day and then think you're all high and mighty ahead of the classics, which is probably not a good thing. You can come up here and just get processed by the machine, by the system, like we just talked about, and that can go, okay, this is where I'm at now. There's a stage race coming with Torino or Paris-Nice, and it's the last chance of improvement you've really got, the last stepping stone towards the big one days in about a month's time.
We look forward to doing these races all year, and then suddenly on the eve of them, there comes this little bit of, well, for me anyway, I guess it's a little bit of fear and a little bit of nervousness around it, because you just, like I just, well, we both spoke about how hard they are and how much your day can differentiate by just small things, punches, taking a corner on the wrong side of the roundabout, suddenly you lose 50 wheels, you can never get back before that climb, and so on and so forth. So the nervousness comes in, and there's always, for me, what brings me back is this, maybe it's my year this year, you know, maybe it's going to happen, and whatever that might be. Is that something that you have? Like, we were talking about it today out on, it was nice being in Girona because we escaped the recon, and maybe 3 weeks ago I was looking forward to the recon, but as it came on the eve of it, now the race is on the eve, it's sort of like, do I really want to be up here?
Totally. There's definitely an element of not nervousness. Like, there's a wee twinge. There's a wee, you know, we pull up there in Ghent on Saturday morning in the big shed, basically behind the velodrome there where they run the 6 day, and all the buses park inside. So it's kind of a gloomy sort of a feeling anyway. Then you're into the velodrome and the smoke machines are going, the DJs are there, the tunes are pumping, the crowds. Well, probably not this year, but normally pretty well packed in there.
Mitch Docker fan clubs outside our bus.
Mitch Docker fan clubs outside the bus singing like a football hooligans. You know, we've missed it this year. The first time we turn into the cobbles, whether it be the recon or it's going to be race day on Saturday now, you really forget how rough they are. Like, it's turned into the first sector this year and I'll be like, boom, all right, here we go, we're on. There's that passion in there that we've got in us coming, you know, just... like you said, how can I make the front this year? Like, maybe it's my year, maybe I'm going to make the final, you know. Yeah, anticipation's real.
Hey Scud, so now we're really in Belgium and we've just ridden the Skelder. We're back. Sun is shining. What are you thinking, mate? Happy to be back here?
Oh, back. Belgium's Belgium, mate. Doesn't change, does it? Bike pass on the road. Couple sector here or there.
Feels good to be here after our long travels.
Yeah, it does. Sun shining and already been around the guys, you know, you feel good. Pre-race day ride, massage this afternoon, nice lunch, nice dinner, numbers on.
Beautiful. Alright, so night before, we're here, we're at Hotel Lochren. This is our little base up in Belgium. I've spent a fair bit of time here, you've actually spent more time than me here. Describe the hotel, but also describe what happens in Belgium for people who don't live in Belgium over the classics period.
Yeah, well, the hotel here is, it's not like skyscraper or anything like that. It's a smaller hotel. I don't even think it's part of a chain. It's a one-off. And, you know, we pretty much, when we move in as a team, especially now in the COVID times and separate rooms and everything, we pretty much take over the whole hotel. So it's a good feel here. Our staff are happy because there's a running track out the back around the lakes and they can get around there, and we get really well looked after with the food. Awesome food here. So for me, it's a bit of a homely feel. This is my fifth year in the team now, so they started this hotel when I first joined. So
we come up, riders who aren't from Belgium or the Netherlands or this part of the world, we come up from Spain. Opening weekend, we're only here for a few days, but once we get into the classics block, it's like I'm here for a month. Once we come up again, all the way through to Roubaix, we move out the last week or so, but it's a month on the road, so you really settle in, you really make it home, and you just spend a bit of time here.
What do you do to make hotel life more like home and not feel like a hotel?
Get up every morning and make my own bed, have a shower after breakfast, the normal things.
Do you make your bed at home?
I make my bed at home, yeah.
Okay. That's funny because I don't make my bed at home, but I make it ritually when I'm away on a race. Like, I can't leave the hotel room without my bed being made. As soon as I get home, I'm more than happy to get up and get going in the day without making my bed.
Send the old messages out to a few friends and family, Instagram, WhatsApp, whatever's going, Facebook. When I'm actually on my bed, I try and get a bit of time to do those messages that I never actually get around to doing much.
Do you sit on the bed or do you try and sit at this little desk thing here sometimes to try and change things up?
In the past, when I was running a laptop, I set up a wee office in the corner with the table and chairs, but now I'm tending to just slide onto the bed a lot more and just be lying down the whole time.
All right, let's get into the race tomorrow. We've just had our big meeting. We do our meetings. For anyone who doesn't know, what happens before races is we have this team meeting. And on a stage race, you probably do that every day in the bus just before the race because there's not a lot of time. It's better just to talk about the race just before the race so it's fresh in your mind. And at the end of the race, some teams debrief. We do it on and off, our team, in the bus at the end of the race before you go to the hotel. But classics, we do a big meeting the night before because there's too much to cover. The morning of the race, you want to just get to the race and have your time to get dressed, sign on, all that crap. So we've just had our meeting downstairs before dinner, and then it's dinner. Run us through the team meeting, mate. What'd you think of that, and how's it go for one of these classics?
These classics meetings we have, the race pre-race meetings we have, like, it's as close as what we as bike riders would be like in an office having a board meeting, you know, with the objectives for the week of what's laid out in front of you. But we just go through the course in incredible detail, down to what kind of drink mix we want in the bottles at certain kilometres of the stage. Do we want this drink mix or do we want that drink mix, you know, at different points of the race? The lefts, the rights, the ups, the downs, key sections of the race, which way the weather conditions are, analyse other riders. We just cover it all and go through the objectives, each rider's role throughout the race.
Are you finding it now easier? Because I remember when I first started these meetings and I didn't know the roads, because in the team meetings, I have to refer to different hills, you know, that we go on the Harhook, we go to the Lieberg, after the Lieberg, we go down to the Beendries, over the Beendries, and then we've got the big road. After the big road, we're heading up to the Valkenburg, and after the Valkenburg, we're going down, and then we're going up Vossenhol, blah, 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 blah. For me, in the first few years, it took a long time to understand what anyone was talking about. And you got in the book and you're trying to follow in the book. What did he just say? Vossen what? And now, it's funny, as they're saying those names, my mind is running through that road like I'm on a video game and I'm watching it on Zwift, like, oh yeah, that's right, top of that climb. Are you doing that now? Are you at that point?
Yeah, like, for a start, I had no idea what was going on. And it's not something you can just, like, okay, read this and you'll learn it. It's, you just have to spend time doing it. In the early years with this team, I came out and did a few recons and still had no idea what was going on. But yeah, it wasn't like so much the names of the hills or the climbs or the cobble sectors. It was, we're going to race until the petrol station. At the petrol station, we're going to turn right. You know, here comes the bus stop. Get past the bus stop all the way along until we get past the field with the big mushroom statue in it, you know?
And we go across that sector that hurts like hell, and I got dropped there last year.
I think even tonight there was, you know, where that Mercedes passed us in the recon yesterday, you know, on that piece of road, you know, things like this. You just have to spend time doing it. And the more, as the years have gone on, like, the more common or the more frequent we've been doing it, the more you get to know them. So definitely helps knowing where you're going up here in Belgium.
Let's talk about tomorrow quickly. Het Nieuwsblad, first classic. What do you expect personally, and what do you expect from the race as a whole?
Just, I expect hard, fast. I mean, there'll be times where it's a little bit calm, but there's rolling out of the start in Ghent there. It's, everyone's like, it's finally here. You know, the thing we've been training for all winter. The start's about to happen. and then we just leave town at a fast rate of knots, and it's just going to come thick and fast, and we're going to get to the business end of the race, and it's really going to come. It's pretty simple, really. If you've got the legs, you'll have a good day. If you don't, you'll ask yourself a few questions as you're riding into the finish.
What are you secretly hoping for yourself? Because no one's going to hear this until the races have happened, and we can check in tomorrow night and see if it happened. What are your mini goals in your head? I know you got the team plan. Well, let's tell me what the team role is for you tomorrow, and then tell me what your personal goals are, what you want to get out of the race.
Well, we've got a fair bit of freedom tomorrow. So we pick a moment in the race where we can stretch the legs and try and put yourself in the final of the race. So when you got that freedom, you got to take these chances. So are we looking to get up there in the right moments and play some cards?
What are you thinking?
Deeper into the race, the better.
Have you envisioned the moment?
I've envisioned the moment looking in the race book and the kilometres on the thing. I'm only going to know where to go once we actually get there in the race, as we missed the recon yesterday.
Yeah.
But it's going to come at a super hard part of the race, and when there's guys starting to go, you just got to tag yourself on one of those groups going, and that's how you play your cards.
Are you going to be able to... So at this point, one thing I do to myself is I go, how do I want to feel when I get into the bus tomorrow? Or how do I want to feel getting on the flight tomorrow night? What am I going to be able to sit back and go, yeah, I'm happy with that? What is that moment going to be for you tomorrow where you can get on the bus and go, yeah, you know what? I'm content.
Just playing the cards. When the opportunity arises to play the cards, play them. Don't sit on it. Don't go, oh, I should have gone. Don't spend the next 15 going, is now the moment? Just, if you feel it, go. Obviously, the tank's going to be empty at the end of the day, but don't come back to the finish with anything left in the tank.
Well, there we have it. Opening weekend done. Done and dusted. We're sitting back in the bus with two solid days of racing in the legs, and we're heading to Paris, actually, to fly back to Spain. Long way around, but it's looking good. I've got Tom here with me, my travelling companion. Mate, we didn't get the chance to check in last night. It was a really late night. So let's first of all start off with Het Nieuwsblad, the first race that day. Tell me how the race went down, mate.
Well, we had a pretty relaxed start as opposed to other years. A cold, foggy start, but the roads were dry. So the bunch was, for opening weekend at least, was somewhat relaxed heading out there. The first 100K, and then the race really cracked off, so it was short-lived. But bloody hard day, as always. And yeah, that's pretty much how it went.
Now, run me through your role, firstly, and then secondly, run me through what we talked about the night before, your ideas about what you wanted to get out of the race and how that ended up.
Well, yeah, I had the envision in my brain to go as far and deep into the final as I could, but it wasn't to be the case, as per usual. Sort of run out of legs here this weekend, a bit earlier than what I thought I was going to have, and... yeah, you start questioning yourself there when you're riding in the group pedo, going, whoa, I've done all this training all winter, but I make it 160Ks into the race, and she's good night nurse.
What was your job exactly?
Job exactly was to help our two leaders into key moments of the bike race, before a certain sector or before a certain corner, and be there if we could, but that was all... going up in smoke as we're fighting into these corners, and like it's a super super hard thing now because every director and every one of those team cars is telling their riders, their seven riders, the exact same thing. Corner at 153, be in the front. Okay, the road's only so wide and there's not exactly room for 160 bike riders to go around that corner in the front, so things happen and there's plenty of leaning on, plenty of elbows out, and as we saw, multiple crashes in each one of these corners.
Tell me about one of the most memorable parts of Saturday for you. It could be a good or bad, but something that sticks in your memory from this year's opening weekend, because for me, the last time I did it was 2 years ago, and actually every year I remember it being very bad conditions. 2 years ago it was raining and it dried up, and you know, you're just fighting the weather and the cold. But this year, and the stress, this year, like you said, it wasn't as stressful, but things amped up. The break went pretty easy, but then, you know, with the good weather, that meant everyone was a bit fresher when it came to the harder sectors, so things exploded towards the end. So for me, I came unstuck on the Molenberg, took a cheeky shortcut. If anyone's watching on TV, you'll just watch it and you'll see me take the cyclocross route, which gets you halfway through the peloton.
From the back to the front in no time.
So, and then we sort of gathered up there. But what was something that you remember from the day that sticks out?
I actually had Chris Lawless come up to me about 3 kilometres before the Molenberg. And he said to me, I always find myself riding with you here at this Molenberg every year. I said, that's it, mate. This is usually where it's all over. And sure enough, that was to be the case. So he called it 3Ks out. Yeah, there was a crash in the corner before the Molenberg. Sprinted down for the next 2Ks to turn left into the Molenberg. And same thing again, standing still at the bottom as you see the front of the peloton racing off across the top. So it's a bloody hard thing to get right. But, you know, that's what it is, opening weekend. It's the start. It's the start of what's to come. So you definitely know where you're at after Saturday's hit news blood.
All right, let's quickly go into Kern then. Kern, Brussels, Kern. So very untypical to a lot of one-day races is that we have two big one-day races back-to-back, which for me often can be the worst thing because you go into Het Volk, or Het Nieuwsblad, sorry. You go into Het Nieuwsblad thinking, I'm not really on it today. I'm just going to pull it up and save it for tomorrow. And then you get into Kerno and you realise, well, I still did it, whatever, 150, 160K in the race. So you're tired. And you get into Kerno and you think, I'm a bit tired from yesterday. You end up having two sub-par races, opposed to just committing to one race, one-day race, 100%, emptying the tank. That can be a bit of a curse with that. So then, after the first day coming to Kern, were you thinking to yourself, okay, I want to make up for something, I want to prove something, or were you like, look, I'm content with where my form's at now, I know I still got some work to do and I'm just going to have to try and be the best asset that I can for the team? What were you thinking about today's race?
Obviously, the day before was super hard, so didn't exactly have the diamonds in my legs. This is a common term that's used. So when you know your level's not quite there, and then you got to line up again the next morning, you know, it's get home to the hotel, big plate of pasta, or massage, big plate of pasta, and then it's like, okay, the pasta's done, it's not relaxed now, let's go through to the next room and have a meeting about what we're going to do tomorrow. It's sort of a bit, ugh. Yeah, I think my approach coming into Kona was, okay, we've been chewed up and spat out yesterday. Just how much can we take again today? And in my mind, I was like, I just got to push as hard as I can to take every little bit out of this race to go forward to the next coming races. And sure enough, it was another nice blue sky sunny day in Belgium. A little bit cold, but more of the same. Just wasn't quite on it, didn't quite have it. The fighting into the corners and a few missed crashes, and it's all of a sudden you're going, oh, you know, I'm not getting back to the front now, so got to make the most of it. And end up finding myself in a group. And after 158 kilometres of the bike race, we were turning off the race course to take the shortest way back to Kerner with some local Belgium knowledge of the fastest way there. So I was pretty thankful for that.
How many K was it from where? So tell us about when you came unstuck. And how fast was it back to the finish for you?
So I came unstuck at a climb called the Canaryberg, and then we head towards the Côte de Trieux, the Quartemont, and then the last climb of the bike race, the Kloosberg. After that, it was mostly tailwind back, but yeah, 155 or 158 or something. It was like, all right, guys, if we turn right here, in the small group that we were, it's pretty much straight down this canal to Kona, so rather than go around and to do the final. So we rode the canal, I mean, the sun was shining. We were along the side of the canal. It was smooth, and the race was just gone. Like, it was quiet. It was a long 20Ks back to the bus, and that whole 20Ks, you're just considering, like, what, how, why. I've just done 3 months of solid winter training, and it just feels like you've done it for nothing.
And that's what we say about opening weekend. It can be, we said this already a few days ago, it can be the worst and the best thing. So those 2 days are done. Now we've got this travel home, and let's check in. I wanted to talk to you one more time on our way home and finish off that story about how you've got to where you are today. So we'll have a chat tomorrow, maybe.
Yeah, sure, no worries.
All right, here we go. This is the final installment. We've started in Girona. We went to Barca. We went back to Girona. We went back to Barca, across to Belgium. We did our recon. We did our races. Travelled back in the bus to Paris. And now we're on our flight back to the homeland, Spain. Scud, let's pick up where we left off. We started talking about the start of your career, and we ended just as you were heading back to New Zealand. You'd had the call or the email from Rally, and you were saying, amazing what happened in 24 hours. You went from, I don't even know what I'm going to do, get off the plane, and all of a sudden you've got a contract there sitting. And I guess there's two things when I think of it is, yes, you are going away from home, but it's just same language, you know, same sort of culture. You've been in more difficult situations in the Toulouse, in France. So to a degree, was it sort of comforting knowing, okay, I reckon I can handle this?
Yeah, it was. I mean, the year just gone, I'd been in Toulouse and we'd raced all the French races, you know, Tour of Normandy, Tour of Bretagne, up to the Netherlands for the Olympia Tour, Thuringen-Rundfahrt, Val d'Aosta in Italy, you know. Then on to do the Stag Giro, and had a huge step up there with some of the bigger races. I was quite confident in my abilities to ride a bike at this point, and you know, whatever the UK was going to throw at me, sure I'd better handle it.
What was then your line through the UK? You went across with Rally, and you know, you eventually transferred over to Madison Genesis. Was there always an aspiration to keep growing and keep pushing, and I want to get back to Europe, I want to go over to the top level, or was it like, you know what, I don't mind this scene, I'm earning a bit of coin, I'm enjoying myself here, I'm enjoying the racing, I could just settle down and just be pretty content here?
Yeah, that was it totally. I mean, first of all was try and get some runs on the board at Team Rally, and I managed to get a few of those and a few of those crits, and you know, like, obviously the other teams in the UK all start taking notice when you start winning races. And then I don't even remember how it came around, but we started talking to Madison Genesis later on in the year, and Roger Hammond was the DS there. They were just a new team when I first arrived at Rally, so we raced them a lot, and yeah, moved over to Madison. Had a great time there at Madison. Ended up staying where I was living in Derby when I was riding for Team Rally. And it's, if anyone knows Derby in the UK, she's well, you wouldn't call it the Costa Brava or Surfers Paradise in Australia or anything like that. But for me, it was home. Ended up being home for 3 years. I did a 2-year stay with Madison, mainly because I love the UK scene and the passion. There is passion in the UK. Like, the bike racing scene is unreal, you know. Like, they're pretty particular on a lot of things. Like, simple things like just going for a bunch ride, or as they say, the chain gang. You have to have mud guards if you're going on the chain gang, and little rules like this, and how you should wear your cap and everything like that. So there's a big passion there, and I love being part of that too. Plus all the racing too. I enjoyed the racing, being the crits, and you know, it suited my style coming off the track. So actually, my second year in the UK, my first year with Madison, I was starting to wonder, like, okay, is this going to be it now? Do I just race in the UK for the rest of my career, or... Yeah, I can do well in these races here, but how do I get out? I still had that hunger, you know, like, how do I get up to that World Tour level into these big teams? So it was a hard one, and a decision that I don't regret now. But first of all, I came talking with Drapac in Australia. They were wanting to, how many continental teams out there say, oh yeah, we're going to go Pro Conti next year, and we're going to go bigger calendar, and it's going to be like this. You know, a lot of them say that. And this is what they were saying at the time. And so I was thinking, okay, do I go with them and do that Pro Conti gig, or
Do I stay in the UK where I'm quite happy and quite content and enjoy the racing scene?
How did you hear about that? Like, how were you sort of in the... Because once I get the feeling too that once I come overseas, it's really hard to stay in touch with what's going on in Australia. And you being in the UK, you're in your own scene, you're hearing about other UK teams, maybe you're hearing about some little bit of European stuff, but you sort of only hear about your own little world. To hear about what Drapac was doing all the way back in Australia, and for them to think about you or you to think about them, how did that all come about?
I guess it was just sort of, you know, you win a few races, you get yourself noticed. One of the races I went reasonably well in when I was in France was the Tour of Normandy. Won a prologue there and I think finished third overall with Madison. So, yeah, I think through my manager and through talking with the DSs and the team, they were like, okay, yeah, we'd see you fit for our team. So, look, I wanted to do it, but at the same time, I was quite happy where I was. And I made the decision, you know what? No, I don't want to come. I'm going to stay where I'm comfortable and happy here in the UK and do another year, the second year with Madison Genesis. And from that year, I had one eye on Drapac the whole year. I was like, and I was pleasantly surprised that, you know, they went out and said that what they were going to do. We're going to go and race in the States. We're going to have an uplifted program. We're going to be pro continental. And I was like, well, shit, you know what? Those guys at Drapac did what they said they were going to go and do, bump up to pro conti. And 12 months later, we had the same conversation. Hey, we'd really like you to come to the team. Are you interested again? And at that moment, I was like, you know what? They said we're going to be racing in the States and rah, rah, rah. I thought, wow, you know what? Hey, I'm a track rider. I'm a crit rider. I'm not quite sure if, you know, the Tour of Utah, the Tour of Colorado, these long mountain climb stage races at altitude is really going to suit me. So that's kind of why I was happy in the UK. Like, I didn't want to go and throw myself into an environment where I'm totally not going to fit. And I made the decision, you know what? If I don't go now, I'll be here in the UK for the rest of my career. Because it's hard to win enough races for big teams to take notice of you in the UK, because they go, oh, what's the scene like there? They don't even know. Come to Europe and race properly, you know? So as much as I didn't want to leave Madison, I made the heavy decision to go, okay, I'm going to go off to Drapac.
Did Drapac then come to you that second year, or did you sort of come crawling back?
No, it was sort of mutual, I think. And, you know, we got to... like December, and the emails are coming through, and like, okay, team camp, and rah, 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 and this is what's going to happen. And sure enough, one email that came through was, actually, guys, we're really going to advance the program even further in 2016, and we're not going to be in the States anymore, so you need to be living in Europe. So for me, that was like, oh, beauty. Like, I thought I was leaving the UK, going off to race in these altitude stage races in America. But turned around, it was like the coin flipped my way, and it was, okay, we're going to be racing in Europe and going to do a full European program. So for me at the time, it was the perfect step I needed to lift myself up another level out of racing in the UK onto the bigger scene in Europe.
Then take me through now this transition. So Drapac sort of made that step for you, that halfway step. You're in Europe. You're racing the races in Europe. You're doing a few top level races. You're doing a few lower level races, but that's ultimately what you want to do. You just sort of want to dip your toe in, be in really good form at the big stuff, and then just sort of try and get through the smaller stuff on not so good form and just get the feel of the racing. And this was like the most ideal scenario. You'd be able to set up a little bit of base in Girona, I think. And then this collaboration came with Drapac and Cannondale. And ultimately, you were one of the guys who got brought on that deal. And that there was the step to the world tour. It was happening. Tell me about those transitions.
Yeah, well, it was like we had a good training camp and the feeling was pretty good. And my whole approach coming into Drapac was like, okay, it's pro conti now. And at this moment, it changes the cycling for me. It's like the mentality is you're either a winner or you're a helper. It's a professional team. You're going to get taken to a race and they're going to give you an instruction to do your job, and you go and do that whether you feel like winning that day or not, or can win or can't win. You just turn up and do your job, and that's the mentality I brought in. And our first race was the Sun Tour in Australia, you know, after a good summer down there, and we all got called in and said, okay guys, here's a non-disclosure agreement, you're not allowed to talk about this. And basically it was saying that they were going to merge later in July with Cannondale. So right there, the first race, it was like,
this is how fast, this is how hard that Michael Drapac wanted to press on with advancing his team from Continental to the World Tour and joining with Cannondale at the Tour de France. So for me, my eyes are just getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Like, not only was I gone thinking I was going to race Pro Continental in the States, now we're in Europe. In July, the team's merging with the World Tour team. Like, the ramp of acceleration just going up and up and up as far as progression's going.
And did they make it sort of a, not like a competition, but do they sort of indicate like, hey, there's 3-4 riders going to go across, you need to be in the top 3-4? What was that feeling like between the riders in the team?
Okay, so the immediate thoughts is in that room right there and then everyone's like, all right, I have to win races if I want to make it. But they squashed that straight away because they wanted obviously to have a good season with their team, Pro Continental, and do it properly. Right there and then they said, we're not going to take the guy who wins 10 races. Yes, there'll be a percentage of riders and staff who moves to the new team, Cannondale Drapac, but it's not about who wins the most races. You know, we're going to look for helpers, we're going to look for guys who just turn up and do their job. So right there and then it was come back to that mentality of like, okay, I'm not the guy who wins 15, 10 races a year. I know I can help guys win races. 2016, the whole season was just all about helping my Drapac teammates try and win races, whether it be in the sprints with Brenton Jones or supporting the climbers into climbs, as well as, you know, my opportunities would be in a time trial and I'd push for those and breakaways and things like that in these races around Europe and France.
Okay, well, fast forward now to when the deal did happen and then you eventually pulled on the green jersey as it was back in those days. What was that like, and getting that knowledge that you were going to be one of the guys taken across? Was it not bittersweet? I guess it was happy, but you sort of felt like, I felt sorry for some of the other guys, your teammates who didn't quite make it, who you thought in your mind should have been World Tour level. Not enough room for everyone, I guess.
Yeah, it was pretty hard because like you're like something that you've been like slogging out all these years for to happen, and then you're in an environment. I remember being in Belgium. It was still June when it happened for me, and I'd won a race and I'd gone well in a prologue, and so they're okay, that's enough for us, Tom, like you're helping your teammates, we want to see you make that step, so we'd like you to come with you. They offer you the contract, it's like, but then you can't tell anyone. Whoa. You know, like, because if you just turn up in the morning and say, hey boys, I signed the new deal, like, you're a bloody, what kind of guy are you then? You know, I wasn't allowed to tell anyone. So as happy as I was to sign, I had to just like keep it quiet and do it all a bit like secretive, like don't show your emotion. I was pretty stoked and I was like, okay, it's getting real now, you know, like I've made a step this year with Drapac and I've got to make another step again next year. And well, from now on, it's like I've really got to just be that professional athlete.
There's a couple more things I wanted to ask you about now, because now you're in World Tour and we met in your second year with the team when I joined the team. And what I want to sort of talk about is that first impressions of being at World Tour. You've done a lot of cycling all over the world before there. And then, you know, we talk about this, making this jump to World Tour. Whoa, the big jump. First of all, was it a big jump? And did you feel fish out of water and learning a lot of things? Well, firstly, let's talk about that.
If I go back even to my times in the UK with Madison, we were pretty well looked after. We were treated professionally. We had all the equipment we needed. And the program was good. Like Roger Hammond really directed a good program there. And I learned a lot from him and other directors that he brought into the team who had been World Tour for many years. So to then progress on with Drapac, it was the same mentality. Same, like you turn up, you do your job and just be ready to go whenever we asked. So it was kind of, the year at Drapac was a really good stepping stone towards Cannondale Drapac at the World Tour. It ramps up a little bit, but also the level of support you're getting from the team, you know, the equipment, the soigneurs, it all just ramps up and it actually becomes easy. You know, like my first race was the Tour Down Under and I wasn't on it, I was just a reserve. And 2 days from flying to Europe, you know, the Tour Down is about to start. So once the Tour Down starts, it's like, okay, Tom, you're not needed. Off to Europe you go. So one of the guys fell sick on the eve of the Tour Down Under crit, and then I had was literally just about to go for a mountain bike ride. I get the first email or the first phone call. It's like, Tom, where are you? Can you make it to the airport this afternoon? And I'm like, you know what? I'm going to go for a mountain bike ride and then I'm going to come home and pack my bags for Europe. I just want to go for a ride first. As I was getting ready for the ride, I just checked my email. Oh, shit. Like, okay. Yeah, I can do that. I literally got the clothes off the line, threw them in a suitcase, and we drove to the airport within an hour so I could make the flight. And I had the bare bones pack straight over to Adelaide. Like, the boys had already had dinner, like the pre-race meal the night before the Tour Down Under, and I hadn't even arrived yet, you know. I ate dinner by myself and then woke up in the morning and said, hey guys, I'm Tom, you know. Like, I didn't have time to think. Like, I didn't have time to get nervous. It was just like, turn up and do your job, you know.
Well, let's fast forward then now to today's day and age, and I guess that's, 5 years ago now that this is your fifth year in World Tour?
Yeah, this is the fifth year, yeah.
And talk to me about that in your own mind, that change. And if you can think back to those early days and hitting the classics, and we've just gone through the classics, and yes, they still are a shock to the system, but you know the machine. I'm not talking just about the classics. I'm talking about the way the season goes, the role of the season, how you need to be informed, how you know when to put the pedal down, when to back off, going into a Grand Tour, getting through a Grand Tour. I'm talking about everything. Think about in the beginning when your eyes were just getting opened up to now how you take on things as a, you know, as a well-groomed pro these days, and how you take it on.
I mean, traditionally I've always started with Down Under after that first year, and that's a great way to start because you get broken into it. It's nice and sunny and it's warm and the stages aren't incredibly long, and then you come to Europe. The first race in Europe's always a real shock, and quite often for me, after doing the Australian block, it's opening weekend. And sure enough, just as we've found this weekend, opening weekend goes one of two ways. You either got really good legs and you're on a good level, or you just get chewed up and spat out like what's just happened. Yeah, from there, these next three weeks are really crucial to bumping up the level again. You either get a Paris-Nice or a Tirreno in your legs before coming back to the classics. Classics, you get a bit of downtime, and then, okay, righto, there's either a tour coming, whether it's a Grand Tour or a series of shorter stage races, and then after that, things will start to simmer down after July or ramp right up again if you're going on for the Vuelta.
But how do you mentally face that now? I think, you know, it's a big load, and you've got to find out yourself, and you've got to also find your place. If you can think back to the original days, sort of 5-6 years ago, when you were getting hit with these races, bang, Down Under off the cuff, come across, opening weekend, whoa, what was that? And you think about yourself now, and you're like, yeah, you still find it tough, but like I said, you're a well-groomed pro, and that's just part of the day-to-day job. And you know when you got to be good, and dealing with all the extra stuff, you know, living up in Andorra, sorting out all the extra stuff. It's part of the job, you know. And when we say being a pro, it's not just racing your bike good. It's about not getting sick. It's about training well. It's about creating your own little bubble environment. All that stuff. You think about all that, and you think back over the years where you're at now. Tell me about that realization, that progression, and I guess where you're at now with that all.
You know, when I was first with Drapac Pro Conti, I moved to Girona. And why? Because, well, my mates are there. And two, I didn't really know anything else or what to do or how to do it. So that's a huge part of being a pro and being World Tour pro is what, like, 5 years in now, well, started my fifth year, the last couple of years, what I've noticed is the training, you know, like, I used to look at and go, oh my God, how am I ever going to be able to do that sort of training? That's the easy part now. You know, that's just what you do. You just get on, okay, today I've got 5 hours, I'm going to go and ride 3 climbs, whatever it might be. That's the easy part, the living the life, the making the airport shuttle, the organising your residency, meetings, all these other things, side things, that snowball into bigger things if you don't get on top of them and don't sort them out straight away. That's the harder part to being a World Tour pro. Like, dealing with all that stuff, like missing flights, missing, you know, whatever it might be, that can actually if you don't stay on top of that and you're not organised, that actually comes back and impacts your training, your recovery, which then turns takes it out of your performance. It's really easy to let that stuff take over. So, you know, at certain times of the season where you've really got to be on, and like for me it's the classics, then it's a bit of a downtime where I can really get into sorting all those things out after the classics, and then okay, what's next on the thing, where are we going next, and then build towards that.
And finally, over these years, and you think back, like I said, think back over all those years coming through, you know, time in time over here and then back in the UK and then now being back in Europe, what are the things that you really do love of being a pro, you know, professional cyclist? You go back to New Zealand and people ask you, yeah, what is it like? What do you really love about doing that job? Who don't really understand it? What is it that you love about that job, about this job?
I guess what I really love, shit, that's the hard question. I guess I love when it all, you find a moment. It might not be that you win a race. It's not happening too often for me these days, but or when your teammate wins a race because you played a crucial role in what he was wanting to do. It's a very satisfying thing. I do like the start off the winter training, the build up, you know, you go through the wave of emotions. You go from, shit, is this even my bike? It doesn't even feel like it when you start. Or how do I even ride a bike? To then, okay, the fitness is coming, races start happening. Oh, gee, that was, felt like I've never raced before. To then, oh, I'm starting to get a little bit of form. I like that process of building up the fitness, getting your head kicked in a few times, then you see, start to see the light at the end of the tunnel. All right, we're getting closer, it's game time now. And then poof, I need some rest, and then okay, let's switch off for a while, and then boom, let's switch it all back on and set your targets on something else. I like that whole process as an athlete and as, you know, as a cyclist. So
beautiful, mate. That is exactly right. That process of being in control and, you know, setting out your goals and having everything planned in front of you. I think that's a really, really nice part of what we do. But, well, we're getting to the end of our journey now. I hope this has been an interesting podcast for everyone. We're travelling back, and this has just been a few days on the road with Tom, and also a little insight to what our life is like on such a weekend away when we go racing. So, mate, thanks for being on the pod. Thanks for all your time recording.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
Well, I hope you really enjoyed that. That was a weekend on the road with us, and I hope you got a bit of a feel what it's like to be travelling on the road with a couple of pros. What do you think of that, Lionel? Did you sort of get the insight to there what it might be like racing opening weekend one time?
Yeah, I think, first of all, doing the recon ride in Spain for the Belgian Classics must be a first. Maybe it's not. I mean, one of the things that came across as we heard more from Tom was just how much of the lifestyle around the racing you have to crack as a pro if you're going to make it, not just in the World Tour level, but any level as a pro. You know, being organised, coping with the travel, coping with the change to schedules. And he had a phrase in there talking about the racing itself that really struck me. You know, going into a race expecting maybe a certain type of feeling or a certain type of result from the day and just getting processed by the machine. And I think that's, you know, that's the peloton, isn't it? The peloton is this thing of all these moving parts, and you don't quite know until you get in there exactly where you fit. And so these opening races, there must be that sense of nervousness before them. How am I going to fare here? Am I going to be okay, or am I going to be struggling right from the get-go?
Yeah, it's something that's totally underestimated, and I'm not necessarily saying it should be highlighted on TV commentary because we're focusing on the racing at that point, but that is the whole purpose of my podcast, and that's what I loved most about this episode is we finally got to sort of peel back the layers and take the varnish off it a little bit and say, hey, you know, It's a big sort of organization, personal organization of life away overseas for us foreigners living here in Europe. Yes, there's a big element of racing the bikes, and yes, there's a big element of dealing with a race like Het Nieuwsblad, but to get to that point, you've got to deal with all these things. And one of those things is traveling there in COVID times, is having your family overseas. And I really think it's important to address that point, because when you're watching it there on the television, you keep that all in the back of your mind and you can understand what's going through the lives of these professional riders. It's not just literally going out and doing 6 hours. Not that that's an easy thing, but as Tom said, as the years go on, that becomes the easy part. Doing all the stuff around the edges becomes the more difficult part.
Yeah, and with Tom Scully's career progression, you know, just you can't take for granted, or it's rather easy to take for granted, the number of moves and the number of steps and upheavals he had to go through just to reach the point where he could race for a World Tour team. I mean, even in New Zealand, the part of New Zealand wasn't necessarily convenient for him to start racing a bike. So he had to, you know, go and get stuck into the racing in New Zealand first and then try and get himself over to Europe. And we know him over here in the UK because he rode for Madison Genesis and before that for Rally, and then make that final step over to a team that would get him into the World Tour. And I mean, you know, that's quite a journey anyway. And I really got a sense of how, you know, for him, his career sort of unfolded ahead of him, and he was ready to make each step as it presented itself to him.
And I love how humble he is with it. You know, some of those things he was talking about, you know, I'll just move down to Dunedin and work in a bike shop, move away from my parents at 16 years old. He made it, painted this beautiful picture, like, oh, great, that's a great idea. But you think about it and you're like, wow, that was a big decision, you know, and all these things he did on his own. And that's the type of guy he is. He's such a great teammate, a good friend, a humble person. And it comes across in the podcast. And he was a great guy to hang out with, and I often am doing these trips with him, and I'm so happy that we got the mic out for the last couple of days.
Yeah, it was a great listen, Mitch, and I felt like I was on the weekend trip with you guys, going off and getting stuck into Het Nieuwsblad and Kerner Brussels Kerner, obviously without doing the racing bit, you know, the actual difficult bit.
Well, speaking of weekends, I've got a beautiful weekend of racing coming up. I'm heading off to Strada Bianchi. It feels like I was only just there a few months ago, which I was, back in August last year, but it was in the summer. I've just spoken to Matty Breschel, my director, earlier on this evening, and he told me he's at that beautiful hotel where I wouldn't mind actually being stuck at if I did get quarantined, heading back there tomorrow morning, and we're heading into that race. So it'll be a couple of weeks' time till I speak to you guys, but I've got another episode in store for then, and I'm looking forward to speaking to you or recording another episode for you to listen to then. So guys, until then, thanks a lot for listening. You have been listening to Life in the Peloton. The producer of this episode was Will Jones. The music in this episode was composed by Pete Shelley. Thanks, mate.